Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Carr v. Tillery. Mr. Bung.
May it please the Court, my name is John Bungie. I represent Mr. Carr, gentlemen, along with Bruce Carr, who is co-counsel in the case. This case stems from the dissolution of a law firm that was a firm that included Mr. Carr as well as various other partners. The dispute involves the distribution of certain class action fees resulting from cases that were held by the firm but resolved subsequent to the dissolution of the firm. As the Court has seen in the briefs that have been filed in the case, there is a history of litigation between the parties. That litigation was initiated by the defendants, the appellees.
How many lawsuits has Carr filed arising from these disagreements with his former partners, including the separate, you know, lien filings and other lawsuits? So he's got 9 lawsuits here, but he's also filed in other suits, right?
I believe there are, I don't remember the precise number, but I think there are about 3 other lien suits that were filed in the class action cases. That's right, Your Honor.
So about a dozen altogether? That seem a little excessive, perhaps?
Well, Your Honor, if I could explain the context.
As you're doing that, perhaps, let me just alert you to the fact that I was concerned that your brief didn't really reflect the Illinois Supreme Court's decision in River Park, which changed the preclusion law in Illinois to a transaction-based system, not the more restrictive version of preclusion that Illinois had prior to the River Park case. And when you think of 1738 and you think of River Park, it's awfully hard for me to see how the matters that are being now presented in this lawsuit have not already been adjudicated.
All right. Well, to answer both your questions, or to attempt to do so, the litigation initiated in 2004 was brought by the defendants. Mr. Carr then filed suits as a response, including a counterclaim.
And out of what facts did that lawsuit arise?
That lawsuit arose out of facts that stemmed from the distribution of fees pursuant to agreements that predated the agreement at issue in Mr. Carr's underlying federal case.
I know your big deal is that this is now to enforce the memorandum of understanding that was entered into in Mr. Carr's handwriting in 2004, not whatever was going on before, but it seems to me this all in the final analysis is about the formula for allocating fees that arose out of the dissolved partnership.
Certainly the case does involve the allocation of fees out of the...
And the formula, if you will, you know, who gets what percentages do various people get?
Well, that's right, Your Honor, but if I could explain. The 2004 litigation involved the distribution of fees under various agreements that predated the 2004 litigation. We refer to them in the brief.
No, I know what the agreements are.
All right. The litigation that was brought later, that what this case is about the distribution of fees pursuant to the settlement agreement that resolved the 2004 litigation. In other words, what Mr. Carr is saying here is that the 2004 litigation was resolved by the memorandum of understanding to which Your Honor referred, and that since that agreement has been put in place, held enforceable in
2006 by
the claimants. I'm sorry, that the defendants have not distributed fees.
Go back to the podium, please.
Right. That the defendants or the appellees have not distributed fees pursuant to that agreement. And with respect to your question about the transactional analysis, Your Honor, our point in the brief is that we agree that the transactional analysis applies, but the question is, under the transactional analysis, does this case stem from the same set of operative facts as the 2004 litigation?
And right, I understand that, and it seems to me there's a question of characterization here, which is, what are those facts? Is it the particular legal theory, namely which agreements, and is it the MOU, or is it the underlying dissolution of the partnership? And I also, just to complicate matters further, wonder, as we think of how many cases have been filed, what was the status of, I'll just call it, the Madison County case, Carr versus Corrine Tillery, 07-MR-187. That looks like a second case after the St. Clair judgment, in which case you're in the third case, which means this Illinois refiling rule is something that is ancient history. It means when Carr versus Corrine Tillery, 07-MR-187, was, quote-unquote, voluntarily dismissed, it was actually with prejudice.
Your Honor, this case, this RICO case, was filed in the spring of 2007. At that point...
Oh, I know when they were filed, but let's just take a simple case. Suppose there's a lawsuit pending on, you know, between A and B on a contract, and then A and B file a second lawsuit on the same contract in a different court. Maybe one of them's in Illinois, one of them's in Kentucky, whatever. And the first filed lawsuit is resolved on the merits. There's now a good preclusion defense in the second lawsuit if it's still pending, because remember, it's first to decide, it's not first to file. And that's what I'm saying, that's a simple case. So in our case, it's more complicated, of course, because this flood of lawsuits that Mr. Carr files. But in our case, if the Madison County case were effectively dismissed with prejudice, then that would remove this case altogether, because there would be a ruling on the merits. Your argument has to hinge on the fact that it really was a voluntary dismissal without prejudice.
That's right. That the 2007 we're arguing that the 2007 cases were voluntarily dismissed without prejudice,
right,
by Mr. Carr.
That's your argument, and of course we know the labels don't matter. What does matter is actually the substance of it, because even in the federal courts under Rule 41, people can say the second dismissal was without prejudice, but it really is with prejudice by force of the rule.
Well, all I can tell you, Your Honor, is what my understanding of the 2007 litigation is, which is that Mr. Carr filed suits in 2007, in the spring of 2007, approximately March of April 2007.
Mm-hmm.
He voluntarily dismissed those suits within a month or so after filing, before anything of substance had happened.
Why did he do that?
Because he decided that he wanted to bring this case as a RICO action.
Why did he make that earlier?
I don't know, Your Honor. It was a litigation decision, and perhaps it would have been...
Well, he fell into the one filing rule as a result of that.
Well, I don't
understand your distinction of the Schrager case. I don't think you represented it accurately in your brief. Looks like a square holding that the order of the filings doesn't matter.
Well, Your Honor, the issue in the Schrager case was that three suits had been... filed before the fourth suit, which was at issue.
Well, look what the court says. It says the order of filing doesn't matter.
What they were talking about there was the order of filing between suit one and suit two. If we look at page 28 of our brief, we lay out the history.
I don't see what there is in the opinion to suggest that that is a significant fact. Look what they say flatly, the order doesn't matter.
Your Honor, in the context of the case, what I believe they're talking about is the order of the first and the second case, because the first two cases were filed and there was an issue as to whether the second case was dismissed before the first case was filed. The fourth case, which was at issue in Schrager, on the facts of the case, was filed after at least two prior dismissals.
The court says plaintiff maintains case two should not be considered a second filing because it was commenced during the pendency and not following the dismissal of case one, and therefore cannot be properly characterized as a refiling of case one, and the court rejects that.
I understand, Your Honor, but the issue in Schrager...
What's the difference between that and this case?
The difference is...
What is the difference between this statement and what's going on in the present in our case?
The difference is that in Schrager, the case that was at issue was case four.
They're not talking about four. They're talking about one and two.
I understand, but one and two had both been dismissed prior to four.
They're talking about the significance of the relation between case one and two and saying it doesn't matter which is filed first.
I understand, Your Honor, but as we lay out in our...
What's the logic of your position?
The logic...
Why should someone be able to file and dismiss and file and dismiss all these cases?
Well, there are two different points.
What sense does it make?
There are rules that govern whether or not Mr. Carr can refile this case. The one refiling rule, the res judicata rule. And our argument is that the legal doctrines do not apply here. In Schrager, there is no question on the facts of the case that before the Schrager case was filed, there was an issue in the opinion, that is case four, that at least two cases had been dismissed. Now, there was some confusion as to whether case two had been dismissed before case one, but our position is that that doesn't matter for purposes of this case, because the difference between Schrager and Mr. Carr's case, respectfully, Your Honor, is that in Schrager, it is absolutely clear from the opinion that there are at least two cases that had been dismissed prior to the point when the fourth case was filed. Here, that is not the case. Mr. Carr filed his RICO action
But you saw what I read you, in which the argument was made that because case number two had been filed before case number one was dismissed, it didn't fall within the one filing rule. That's what the court said.
I understand, Your Honor.
Why did it say that?
Because they were talking about case one and two, which is different from our case. Because the issue, it would be as if we were arguing about only two cases. What happened in Schrager was there were four cases. And what I'm saying is that Schrager is distinct from our case because under any interpretation of when one and two were filed and dismissed, it was clear in Schrager that at least two cases had been dismissed prior to the case in Schrager. Here, that is not the case. Mr. Carr filed the 2007 RICO suit before the dismissal of the four other suits. Now, for your concern about repetitive filings, et cetera, there is a mechanism in Illinois to deal with that. There is Section 2619A, which says that a defendant may move to dismiss an action where other similar actions are pending, and which gives courts in Illinois the discretion to dismiss a suit on that basis. So there is a mechanism for dealing with your concern. That didn't happen here. Nothing of substance had happened in 2007. Now, you're right. It would have been better if Mr. Carr had decided to file the RICO suit before he filed the other actions, but he didn't make that decision. But the issue now is whether he's barred by the one refiling rule from pursuing this suit, and I submit that he is not, because the text of the rule says that it only applies where one dismissal has occurred prior to the filing. There is a rule in Illinois recognizing the Kellerman case that says the courts can allow cases involving the same facts to proceed simultaneously, and the defendant's interpretation is at odds with that rule. The light has gone on. I've reserved some time for rebuttal.
Let me just ask you a question about the merits. What's the fraud here? This looks like the RICO claim looks like just a breach of contract claim, breach of the memorandum of understanding.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, that's not the way the case is pled, and the fake facts have to be...
What is the fraud? That's what I'm asking you.
The fraud involves various items that are alleged in the complaint.
Give me an example of a fraudulent act.
All right. A fraudulent act alleged in the complaint is that the defendants lied to Mr. Carr, misrepresented to Mr. Carr the formula that they were going to use for allocating fees, that they also made misrepresentations.
How does this relate to the... There's a memorandum of understanding which he agreed to. Are you saying that was induced fraudulently?
Well, that is part of it, but beyond that, what the...
But that's inconsistent with your claim that you're relying entirely on the enforcement of the MOU, not on any underlying flaws in it.
I understand, and we addressed that in the brief, Your Honor. And the crux of the case, the money that he seeks...
You know you're precluded on the validity of the MOU.
And we're not...
Get back behind it, would you please?
The case, if you look at his the demand for damages, the $20 million, those are post-MOU distributions. The MOU is pled in there, but the fraudulent acts are that he alleges a series of fraudulent...
Give me one fraudulent act concretely.
All right. It is alleged in the complaint that the defendants fraudulently gave the bookkeeper of Coring Tillery, the firm that was a successor to the Carr firm, allocation...
That's preposterous. She's not a plaintiff. She wasn't injured. What's that about? Order your subordinate to do something, and that I don't understand.
They gave him her false statements, false allocation formulas.
Knowing
it was false.
Fraud is something. It's deception of the. It's the deception of the. Of the plaintiff, of the victim.
Well, Your Honor,
the deception of someone working for the defendant. Where on earth did that come from?
The allegation in the complaint is that the bookkeeper was given false formulas, and those false formulas were used to determine Mr. Carr's fees according to the defendants. And under the Bridges case, proximate cause in a RICO action does not only is not only limited to misrepresentations made to the plaintiff, it can also be misrepresentations to a third party that then harms the plaintiff, which is exactly what we've alleged here. There was a third party, a woman whose job it was to figure out the fees. She was not given accurate information, knowingly by the defendants, as alleged. Based on that false information, she gave insufficient allocations to Mr. Carr. He was injured as a basis of those false measures.
I don't understand how you could, you know, it's, you know, it's like a situation where accountant commits fraud and. And shareholders are injured by it and so on. But you're just talking about something internal to the defendant's organization. So you have defendants talking to each other and somehow that becomes a fraud against someone else? I don't understand.
But the bookkeeper is not a defendant. The bookkeeper was the woman who was supposed to figure out.
You can turn every breach of contract suit into a fraud suit by saying, well, you know, the defendant told his secretary to leave something out of the contract or something like that.
Well,
it's deception. It's just from the standpoint of Mr. Carr, it seems to me, if they don't follow the memorandum of understanding, they violated the contract. What does it add to that to say that there was deception of the bookkeeper? I don't understand.
Okay.
He looks at the contract. He looks at what he's paid. He sees or he claims that they don't jive. He's not being given what the contract promised him, so he brings a lawsuit. That's fine. What does the internal machinations of the defendants have to do with his injury? He's not deceived. That's the whole point. He looks at the memorandum of understanding. He looks at what he's paid, and he brings a lawsuit. Or put differently, where is the harm from the deception to the secretary?
It's a third. First of all, the case has to be taken as pled at this stage,
and it's not if it's nonsense. You know about Iqbal and Bell Atlantic and so on. I don't accept nonsensical pleadings.
He hasn't pled conclusory pleadings. He's pled specific facts of fraud.
No, but it doesn't make any sense because if your complaint is that they're not following a written contract, then fraud doesn't add anything to that.
Well,
they told him, well, the memorandum of understanding actually means something else, you know, and it's. If they told him, oh, no, it's or there's another contract, or there's this or that, if they lie to him, and as a result, he doesn't know he has a contract claim, that's fine. But if he knows he has the claim, what are these peripheral deceptions within the defendant's little conspiracy, whatever you want to call it, what does that add?
Well, he's alleged a variety of predicate acts, including...
You have cases which say you don't just use RICO to change a garden variety commercial dispute into a, you know, treble damage action, massive litigation, right? It's just if all he wants is what the MOU gave him, that's a simple breach of contract. It doesn't add anything to talk about fraud.
Well, that's not the way he's...
There's no additional injury from the... There's no incremental injury from the fraud. Right? What's the incremental injury of the fact that the bookkeeper was deceived?
Well, there is no incremental injury in the sense that he wants his fees from the MOU. That's right, but he's not pled this as a garden variety business dispute.
No, look, think of it this way. Suppose the MOU is owed $20 million, and so the defendants, or let's say a defendant, one of the lawyers, sends him a check for 50 cents. That's case number one. Case number two, he tells his secretary, well, you know, it says $20 million in the MOU, but actually he's only entitled to 50 cents. So would you please send him a check just for 50 cents? What is the difference between those two cases?
Well, I'd say two things. First of all, has Mr. Carr has pled the case? It's not a case of just a contract.
Just answer my question. What is the difference between those two cases?
The difference is that in this case, in your hypothetical, there are allegations. In this case, there are allegations of misrepresentations being knowingly made to persons so that Mr. Carr would not obtain his fees.
In my case, there's a misrepresentation to the secretary. He says to the secretary, Carr is entitled only 50 cents, so send him the check for 50 cents. And she says, I'll make it a better case for you. She says, well, actually, it says 20 million. So the lawyer says, no, it says that, but, you know, really, it just means 50 cents. It's a misprint. There are other contracts, this. So there you have deliberate misrepresentations to your third party. Now, the question is that actually, in any meaningful sense, different from a situation in which he sends the 50-cent check directly to Carr without it's going through the secretary? Are those different cases?
I believe they are different cases under the RICO statute.
Well, if you think that, you know, fine, but we're not on the same planet.
The difference here, though, Your Honor, is
not
that
here, the difference there.
If in scenario number two, the lawyer is knowingly making false statements to the secretary so that the secretary, the third party under Bridges...
I mean, it's ridiculous, because it doesn't matter whether he goes through her or sends the 50 cents directly. It doesn't make any sense.
Well,
it doesn't make any sense. There's no reason to elevate a breach of contract suit into a RICO suit just because a secretary was the intermediary between the defendant, the breaker of the contract, and the victim of the breach. Anyway, we'll give you some more time after we hear from your opponent.
May it please the Court, I'm Lee Freeman for the law for the defendants, Tillery, Sprong, and Katz. Judge Herndon was correct to dismiss this case both for res judicata and for violation of the one refiling rule. This was a simple dispute over the formula to apply to the distribution of fees. And that can be seen from the 2004 litigation, which bars the plaintiff on the basis of res judicata. There's certain facts that our brief may not emphasize sufficiently that I want just briefly to talk about. Within a week after signing the MOU in the first 2004 litigation, Mr. Carr filed an amended counterclaim. And
so
that...
I have a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about all of that. First of all, I wonder whether, in your view, the amounts to which Mr. Carr would be entitled are different under the pre-MOU regime and under the MOU.
There's a slight difference, Your Honor. The MOU defines it's all the same ball of wax. The MOU defines how the restrictive agreement and the redemption agreement, how they're applied to Mr. Carr or Mr. Katz or Mr. Sprong, and what their respective interests are. It doesn't make a significant difference for purposes of this appeal.
It didn't seem to change much at all. Now, are you arguing, though, that he had some duty arising out of Illinois law or some other law to amend his counterclaim after he filed that counterclaim?
Well, no. What I'd like to point out is he did amend his counterclaim and seek to rescind the MOU.
Right.
And
we've
on
all
page,
done that.
And on page two, he not only had a duty, or he may have had a duty, but on page 240 of the supplemental appendix, in that amended counterclaim, he put in issue all of the cases that he's now complaining about, because he demanded a declaratory judgment that this formula would apply to all the cases on exhibits 5 and 3, which were the cases that were now that he's now saying occurred after the 204 litigation. So he put in issue specifically in his amended counterclaim in the 2004 litigation. He alleged that the defendants had defrauded him, were not going to follow these agreements, and that he needed the protection of the court going forward as to all future agreements. But then, what's worse is that the case was then dismissed by the district court on the basis that the MOU was valid and enforceable.
Well, yeah, here, as I understand it, what happens in September of 2006 is the state court upholds the MOU, right?
Correct.
And so then it's sometime later, in 2007, that he files these four cases.
Right, but the significant fact that we really didn't emphasize enough, he appealed from that judgment
from
on September 2009-6, and that appeal was not decided until December 2007. So while he's on appeal contending that the MOU is invalid and a product of a fraud, he files four state court suits in March and April of 2007, 8 months before the appeal is decided. So he's taking one position on his appeal and a completely different position in the state courts. So he's seeking a tactical advantage by filing all these 2007 suits, and the strategy backfired on him.
See, that's why I probably didn't state it very clearly, but the facts that you're talking about are why I thought that at least the lawsuit, the 2007 lawsuit that sought a declaratory judgment regarding his fees in these various cases, wasn't already a repetitive lawsuit, such that when it was voluntarily dismissed, the dismissal was actually with prejudice, and thus there's just no more litigation to be had.
Your Honor is correct. It was already a repetitive lawsuit violating the one refiling rule as well as res judicata, because in Illinois, the September 29, 2006 judgment is final. It's final.
Even though it's on appeal.
Even though it's on appeal. So it's a final judgment. So yes, three of his cases have been dismissed earlier. So he's out on the one refiling rule already.
Before we even get to this RICO case.
Before we get to the 2007 state court filings, and before we get to the RICO case. So he's barred like three different ways. And then I would just emphasize, but that in part, or in large part, is the reason for our cross appeal on the sanctions. Our reason for cross appeal on the sanctions is this repetitive filing and this attempt to game the system, because he's a lawyer, he's a well-known lawyer with lots of experience, and Ryan versus David Noyes in the Illinois Supreme Court, which this court has discussed recently in Muhammad versus Oliver, I mean, it is clear beyond any dispute that Illinois does not permit serial refilings.
Now, right, but here's my question for you about the sanctions part of this. We, of course, are not an Illinois court, and I looked at the language of 1927, which I'm looking at right now, and it refers to somebody, you know, an attorney, who so multiplies the proceedings in any case. And I have to say, the question that came to my mind is whether that means we're supposed to look at every case he's ever filed about this, including all the Illinois cases, or whether we just need to ask, how did he handle the RICO lawsuit before the federal district court, and did he vexatiously, et cetera, multiply those proceedings?
I think the distinction is the correct one. This is background to, we're only concerned here with vexatiously extending and multiplying the proceedings by the refiling of these lawsuits as the RICO suit.
But what did he do in the RICO? From the minute he files the RICO suit to the end, is this anything? It didn't look to me like it was anything unusual as a case. It's not like there are millions of motions and lots of burdensome discovery.
Well, because the defendants felt they had a solid defenses on both res judicata and mm-hmm. and the one refiling rule, they moved to stay discovery. They moved to they opposed the filing of a second amended complaint. But every time they made a representation to the court, they were met with a Rule 11 motion. Three Rule 11 motions were filed, contending that they violated Rule 11 by arguments that were made in the district court, and there was a substantial briefing. I mean, what we're looking for in terms of sanctions is for the district judge to look at the amount of time and money that had to be expended on this RICO action, which was just a repackaging of these state court actions which were barred by the one refiling rule. So what we're saying is that he vexatiously multiplied proceedings in this case.
Have you ever sought an injunction against his bringing these suits?
In this court. We sought an injunction against, we sought an injunction against the new suits that he's filed in Missouri now.
In Missouri you have asked for an injunction against?
We asked for an injunction while this appeal was pending, and it was denied, against the additional suits filed in Missouri. But no, I don't think.
So there's a suit pending in Missouri now?
Yes, that was filed after.
And was Mr. Bunger right that he's brought about 12 suits?
Oh, it's with the Missouri suits. It's more than that.
It's lawsuits.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Is Mr. Bunger correct in suggesting that, in addition to the 9 lawsuits he's filed against the defendants, there were another 3 in which he had filed?
At least three.
It's lawsuits.
At least three, Your Honor. One came here to this court.
That's the one where the sanction was.
But yes, at least three, and I realize that Your Honors have asked us to address the issue of jurisdiction over the RICO appeal, and I think I think that we rely on ACLU versus City of St. Charles, that the judge has to look at the allegations in the complaint. Mr. Bunge says they're specific rather than what the evidence shows. The evidence, he fails completely in his ability to prove anything.
Does it make any practical difference whether a suit is dismissed for want of jurisdiction because it's so frivolous that it doesn't engage the jurisdiction of the court, or whether it's a dismissal on the merits?
Well, yes, as the court recognized in ACLU versus City of St. Charles and Maher and a couple of other cases, yes, a dismissal on the merits forecloses further litigation. A dismissal for want of jurisdiction gives him the opportunity to file again.
But when a dismissal for want of jurisdiction is res judicata with regard to whatever the ground for the dismissal is, so if the ground for the dismissal is that the suit is frivolous, That is a final judgment on frivolousness, and then it couldn't be refiled, I think.
But that would only be the frivolousness of the federal question, I think, because if it's a Bell versus Hood issue, we asked you to brief Bell versus Hood, as I recall. Is the alleged federal question so insubstantial as not to engage the court's jurisdiction?
Well, that line is, I mean, as you've addressed in United Phosphorus, that line is, and the Supreme Court addressed it in the Steel Company case. That line is rather difficult to draw, whether it's utterly frivolous or.
Here's the question for you: if it's not frivolous enough to dismiss, then it is also not frivolous enough for 1927 sanctions.
And if it's too frivolous, you can turn that around. If it's too frivolous to be in court, it's certainly sufficient to impose sanctions. But we would.
Aren't you just trying to? Are there other claims besides the RICO claim in this suit?
Well, there is a pendent state.
Yeah, there's supplemental state claims, aren't there?
So they weren't relinquished.
No. They were all dismissed on the basis of the race judicata and the one refund.
So we would
like to put this matter at rest, and a dismissal, an affirmance of Judge Herndon would put it at rest.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr.
So, Mr. Bunge, you can have a couple of more minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just make two brief points. The first, with respect to the hypothetical you gave me, Judge Posner, I just want to make sure that I'm clear on what the underlying facts are. The bookkeeper I refer to is named Wolagorski. She's referred to in the complaint. She was a third party. She was not a secretary of the Coring Tillery firm, that is, the defendants. And the reason for that is she was appointed as the agent to handle the dissolution of the Carr firm's allocations. All right. So the allegation in the complaint is that there were false representations made to this third-party agent, which caused her to give Mr. Carr less money than that to which he was entitled, which we believe puts it within the Bridge case. The second point here is...
But what is the deception? If the agent, for whatever reason, sends Carr less than the MOU entitles him to, he sees that immediately and he brings suit for breach of contract.
There is no deception on Mr. Carr because he knows that he's getting less than he thought.
Then how can someone who is not deceived bring a lawsuit for deception?
Because there's a scheme to defraud that involves the third party.
What difference does it make? It doesn't hurt him. Why should someone be able to bring a suit for fraud against a third party when the fraud didn't have any effect on him?
Well, it does hurt him, Your Honor, because the money that he was owed he hasn't received.
But that's the same injury as a breach of contract would inflict.
That's right, but it's not alleged as a breach of contract because there's a scheme to defraud a third-party agent who's responsible for giving him his money, and as a result of the fraud on that third-party agent, he was given some $20 million less than that to which he was entitled. That's the fraud claim. There are also, by the way, other predicate acts alleged, extortion and obstruction, et cetera. On the question of the frivolousness of the case and why this was brought, the important point here from Mr. Carr's perspective is that he was in litigation with the defendants in 2004. They initiated that litigation. He responded with suits. There were suits in 2007. They were all voluntarily dismissed before anything happened. The one refiling rule we've already discussed. But the point is that the case here is one that he should be allowed to proceed with, because what he's trying to do here is not relitigate the issues of 2004. What he's saying is that the settlement agreement that resolved the 2004 litigation has not been followed. And he's saying that the defendants have not allocated fees to which he's entitled under that settlement agreement. And it cannot.
There's a lot in the complaint that concerns the earlier.
That's right. It's pled as background, and under the Tarkowski case.
Pled as background. What does that mean?
It means that he explained.
File a 100-page complaint. Trying to frighten the judge.
I don't know what his motivations were in filing the complaint. I think he was trying to lay out the history of the case. I mean, there have been allegations that the...
You didn't file this complaint?
I didn't. No, I did not file the complaint.
Who filed the complaint?
I believe Mr. Carr and I believe my co-counsel may have been involved, Mr. Carr Jr., who's also a lawyer.
Well, Kirkland filed a complaint, didn't it?
No.
Took over the case later?
That's right. But that's my point is that what he's alleging here is that settlement agreement has not been followed, and that's harmed him. And it can't be the law that res judicata of a suit, that resolution of suit one that results in a settlement agreement bars suit.
Freeman said he complained about the MOU within a week after it was signed.
He did complain about the MOU. That's right. But and the parties had a dispute about that, but that was resolved by the September 2006 judgment holding the MOU enforceable. And the allegations in the RICO suit are that Mr. Carr has not been given the fees to which he's entitled under the MOU, which is a different issue. We cite the LaGrange case, among others. It's different because if
what is the monetary difference? I mean, what is he seeking under the MOU that he was not seeking in the earlier suits?
I don't know the precise dollar figure, but the...
Well, I'm very interested in that. Is it 10 cents? Is it $10 million, or is it what?
$1 million.
Pardon?
According to my co-counsel, it's $20 million. The point is...
$20 million more?
The Rule 7, there were 2007 fees that came down even after we filed that involved millions. The specifics are there in the brief.
But I don't think there's any dispute on this. Before the MOU, there were different agreements that governed how fees were going to be calculated and given out. And the MOU put in place a new formula, and what Mr. Carr is saying now is that after the MOU was in place and held to be enforceable, that the fees...
And the new formula gave him more than the old?
I don't know how they compared.
There were new cases.
If it didn't give him more than the old, then...
It gave him a different amount than the old. Because,
different?
Yes.
That's what I asked Mr. Freeman, too. You know, when all is said and done, what's the difference between the formula, forget about the particular cases to which it's applied, but the formula pre-MOU and the formula under the MOU? And he said there were some minor differences, but not very much. And when I read through the MOU, aside from some things that seemed to confirm, you know, this agreement governs this agreement governs that, and he agrees to drop some lien suits and some other things, it didn't look to me like there was much difference.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't know the dollar difference. All I know is that there were different formulas used prior to the MOU from post-MOU, because prior to the MOU, there were various agreements that had been in place at the company, and after the MOU, there was an agreement.
If the formula isn't more favorable to him, he wouldn't be entitled to any damages, right?
No. I think that if regardless of whether the formula is less favorable or more favorable, he's entitled to the money that he's supposed to get under the new formula.
Yeah, suppose you sue for $1 million and you lose your suit, and then you bring another suit and said, well, actually, you know, after that, they agreed to pay me that $1 million under a different formula. Well, you wouldn't have any damages.
Here's the important point. What he's seeking in the RICO case is not money that was in place at the time of the 04 litigation. There's still fees coming in. Some of the fees that are involved here, we make the point in the brief, are from two cases, the Cooper case and the Clevenger case, where fees were distributed after the order resolving the 2004 litigation. That's his point. He's saying there are fees that are coming in. As we speak, there are cases out there for which this dissolved firm is going to receive fees. And what he's saying is that under this MOU, he should receive a certain amount of fees from those cases as agreed in the MOU and according to that formula. And he hasn't been receiving those fees, and he doesn't think he's going to receive the fees in the future. So it is not the same fees that are at issue in the...
So you're still seeking declaratory relief or an injunction as well as damages, or not?
Well, yes, the complaint has an injunctive relief request, but the $20 million that's itemized as damages in the complaint, those are fees that post-date the MOU. That's what my point. Those are distributions that were not at issue in 2004 because in the 2004 litigation, because they were given out afterwards. Some of the fees, $8 million of the $20 million total, are from Cooper and Clevenger, which is, as you see in our brief, those were fees that were given out after the order resolving the 2004 litigation in 2006. So they couldn't possibly have been resolved in 2006 because they weren't even at issue then. But when the Cooper and Clevenger fees were given out, Mr. Carr wanted to receive the fees that he thought he was entitled to under the MOU, the settlement agreement, and the complaint is that he didn't receive those fees. That's what this is about. He wants to enforce the MOU, the settlement agreement for the 2004 litigation, and the 2004 litigation can't possibly have res judicata effect here because the settlement agreement that resolved the 2004 litigation is the agreement that he's trying to enforce here. And if it does have res judicata effect, then any plaintiff could never bring a later suit after a settlement agreement agreement is reached to enforce a settlement agreement because the other side would argue, well, it's res judicata because of the earlier suit. And that doesn't make any sense.
Okay. Okay. We'll let you have a minute.
The second ground for dismissing the lawsuit is the 2007 state court suits. The 2007 state court suits are identical to the RICO action. They seek to enforce the MOU. And because he filed and dismissed those suits, and the order doesn't matter, and I think the most recent case is the Eckridge case where the second case was still pending when the plaintiffs filed the third case, and this court said Illinois' rule is solid. But the point is that by filing and dismissing those four state court suits in 2007 that allege exactly the same thing, a violation of the MOU, a refusal to abide by the MOU, he has extinguished his contract rights. That's the rule in Illinois. It may be a harsh rule, but that's the rule. His alternative was to simply stay with the appeal he had taken from the September 29, 2006 dismissal, that appeal which was still pending, and abide by whatever the Illinois Appellate Court decided in that case. Instead, he went out and tried to get this tactical advantage with those four 2007 suits, and those four dismissals under the Illinois refiling rule extinguish all his rights under the MOU because he's raised that and he's lost those rights. When he files the RICO action, they're gone under the Illinois refiling rule.
Well, if he is entitled under the MOU to fees in, say, future cases, cases that are resolved, class actions resolved years from now, and the defendants don't pay him anything, then he could bring a new suit, couldn't he?
Well, no, because those cases are listed. Those cases are defined in the 2004 suit, and then those cases are put in issue in the state court suits.
New cases coming up or cases that haven't been...
Well, the only cases he'd be entitled to are cases that existed at the time
right.
he left. If there was a new case...
So there's a schedule of cases, but maybe fees are coming in later?
They were pending cases, but the fees may have come in later. But those fees came in at the time that the 2007 state court suits were filed. So by filing and dismissing those 2007 state court suits, he's waived, extinguished, he's lost his right to enforce the MOU any further.
His fees are coming in as we sit here.
I'm not sure that's accurate. Fees came in subsequent to the September 29, 2006 judgment, but those cases were all encompassed in his complaint in 2004, amended counterclaim, excuse me, and then those fees were all encompassed in his 2007 state court lawsuits that he dismissed. If there is another suit, I'm not sure when the fees would come in, but...
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. So, Mr. Bunga, we'll give you a minute since you're entitled to rebut. But this will be the
last round.
Well, on the fees, Your Honor, in the complaint you'll see that there's allegations of a number of cases where fees are still owed to the old firm, the dissolved firm.
But there are no new cases from that old firm. The only question is whether all the fees have finally come in from this defined set of cases.
Well, that's right, but there's a large population of cases, as alleged in the complaint. And in particular, let me point out two items that are alleged in the complaint that are clear, the Cooper and the Clevenger cases, because those are important. Those cases are $8 million of the $20 million in fees that Mr. Carr seeks in the RICO action. In those cases, those fee allocations were made after the date of the September 2006 order resolving that first round of litigation, the 2004 litigation. Some of those fee allocations, by the way, were made after the dismissal of the 2007 litigation, some portion of the Cooper and Clevenger fees. But in any event, $8 million of those fees were afterwards. And in addition, in the complaint, he alleges that there are all these other fees that are going to be coming down in the course of the next couple of years.
Okay. Well, thank you very much to both counsel.